Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Coming up next hour, we'll look at the Long Beach City Council's approval of a plan that would temporarily shelter up to 1,000 unaccompanied minors who presented themselves at the U.S. southern border. We'll talk about what that's going to mean for the Long Beach Convention Center. We'll talk about the whole process as we have had a record-setting month of March. 19,000 unaccompanied minors presented themselves at the U.S. border and were taken into custody by the United States. That is the largest number of unaccompanied minors come in the history of record keeping. That's coming up next hour, but first we begin with the very latest on COVID-19 and the vaccination efforts. I just mentioned a couple minutes ago that Cal State Los Angeles is taking walk-up 18 and over people to stand in line and to get vaccinated. We're hearing now that there's been such a huge response for people signing up on the state government MyTurn site that has filled up all of the appointments. So it appears they may not be taking walk-up vaccinations any longer at Cal State LA. We're working to confirm that is the case, but there's been a tremendous response since they started publicizing this morning that they had many spots available for the Johnson & Johnson vaccinations. With us to talk about the latest on COVID-19, our weekly guest from UC San Francisco Medical Center, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Dr. Chin Hong, so good to have you back with us today.
So great to be back on, Larry.
So it seems at this point like there's good news that there are some places that do have large quantities of vaccine ready to inject into people's arms. Next week, though, we're told there's going to be a significant drop in the availability of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Not clear whether that's because of the Baltimore factory mess up where you had huge numbers of doses that were deemed unusable. But anyway, it appears we're going to have significantly fewer vaccine doses next week than this week. How does that complicate, if it does, the efforts to reopen June 15th?
I think it's hopefully going to be just a little bump in the road, because overall, I think our vaccine pipeline is still going to be, on average, robust enough so that we can get to that destination. Again, being 10 weeks away, I feel relatively confident that we will have enough vaccine supplies by then. Of course, barring no more, mix-ups in production plants, et cetera. But I've been impressed that President Biden has always under-promised and over-delivered so far with these aspirational dates. So I'm confident, or at least hopeful, that will also be the case with having all vaccinations available for adults soon.
We're hearing differences of opinion over whether June 15th is too ambitious for Governor Newsom to see a full reopening in California with venues and restaurants and public spaces and everything with a full capacity reopening. Everything except, very large scale events like the Coachella Music Festival. What do you think about that intention to reopen June 15th?
Again, I think it's okay to have an aspirational date, but it all depends on how we deal with that information as a community, as a society. So what does reopening mean? Does reopening mean you throw up your masks in the air and have a huge bonfire? Or does it mean that you're going to keep on being diligent? That doesn't mean you can't reopen. as long as our numbers continue to go down. So that's like one issue, how we deal with that information as humans. The second is, you know, being flexible, because again, I know a lot of people are looking at the Midwest, Michigan, Minnesota, and then the rising COVID temperature in the Northeast with some trepidation. So, you know, we look at these clouds and we can be flexible and roll back that date if we need to.
All right, if you have questions for Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You know, though, what the public backlash will be, Dr. Chin-Hong, if we approach June 15th and state or local officials say, no, we're going to put the brakes on this. It's not safe to do it. This is going to be hugely controversial.
Yes, exactly. It's very politically dicey territory. And I guess that was the risk that the governor was willing to take. I mean, again, what my overall feeling is, and I don't want to be a Debbie Downer about this, but this virus continues to shock me with how it changes, you know, as a shapeshifter and, you know, the way it's continuing to evolve. So 10 weeks away is a long way in terms of preparation, but 10 weeks is also a long way away in terms of how the landscape may change.
All right. Again, your questions for Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're hearing that the mRNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna are having good results against the two California variants that have been identified here. Dr. Chin-Hong, you find it a positive development that you're seeing as they test these different variants, at least some degree of coverage here?
Yes, definitely. I have full confidence in our vaccines for the California variant, for the B.1.1.7 UK variant. So, you know, it's all good news. And the fact that this variant was amongst us and we were living amongst this variant December and January during our darkness, yet saw continued improvement currently, suggests that, you know, whatever we're doing is right, because we're able to defeat at least our own homegrown variant if given the vaccinations and so on.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jen of LA says both Pfizer and Moderna have released data on their real-world effectiveness of their vaccines. Does J&J have similar studies in place to share real-world effectiveness of their vaccine?
That's a great question. J&J doesn't have yet those results of real-world effectiveness. It just hasn't been used that long, whereas Pfizer particularly, and to some extent Moderna, have been, you know, the first-in-class vaccines. So there have been countries that have been able to look at their populations like Israel, UK, et cetera, but not so with J&J yet.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tricia writes on the page, will antibodies from a COVID infection a year ago protect against variants and COVID-19? Also, can antibody levels be very high after an infection that goes back as long as a year ago?
That's such a great question. So we know that antibodies probably would last, you know, my gut sense is that antibodies from natural infection would probably last around a year. We know that from the science, it lasts at least 7 to 8 months. But, you know, I think it probably will last around a year. In terms of the variants, it probably will be okay against the UK and California variants. But the scariest variants from a reinfection perspective are the Brazilian and South African variants. In fact, they found that out in Manaus in Brazil, because that particular community or city had a huge surge a few months prior, and then they got a huge surge again, which again was surprising to people because they expected folks to be immune from a natural perspective. And it was because of this reinfection that the variant was found. So again, it depends on the variant, but probably natural immunity wouldn't be great against all variants, whereas vaccine-based immunity is much more reliable, it's much more durable. So that for everyone, I would really encourage vaccination as a real prevention strategy.
Tricia also asks about first dose side effects. You know, we've heard from so many people who had had COVID-19 once they got the first dose of the mRNA vaccine. They had, in many cases, a stronger response to it in terms of, you know, feeling ill and, you know, dealing with the side effects than people who had not had COVID-19 with their first injection. So Tricia's wondering again, you know, looking back a year ago and having had it at that point, do you think that you're still at risk for having the stronger side effects from the initial dose?
I think if you waited 3 months, like the CDC has recommended, if you've gotten COVID, at least 3 months to get your vaccination shot, I think it probably will be okay. But yes, you could probably wait, and this is off the record, as long as probably, I would probably not wait beyond 6 or 7 months. Because then after that point, it's very variable whether or not you'd have protection still.
Okay. You know, though, you're being listened to around the world. I don't know how the off the record goes.
I know. But, I mean, right. I guess it was a figurative speech.
I understand. Yeah, I understand. It's sort of, yeah, your gut sense of it. I get it. And I'm glad you're willing to share your thought about that. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, KPECC.org. There are folks touting an anti-parasite drug as a treatment for COVID-19. The drug ivermectin, people are going to feed stores in some places to get it and the like. What's your understanding of the anti-parasite drug and what effect it has?
So first I'll talk about the science, and then I'll talk about the implications of people going to feed stores and using animal ivermectin as treatment. So in terms of the science, it actually is very, very mixed. It actually, to me, is very reminiscent of the debate we had about hydroxychloroquine. So in the test tube, it looks pretty good. There are some very small uncontrolled studies which suggest that you can get lower viral load of COVID, SARS-CoV-2, with ivermectin. But there haven't been any large randomized control trials. And there was one trial in Colombia or in Latin America showing that there was no benefit of ivermectin.
Okay.
To me, as an infectious disease doctor, I've never seen an antiparasitic used for a virus. So it would be shocking if it actually ends up working. Okay. And then it's super dangerous.
So it is. So there's dangerous in taking it prophylactically?
Well, it's dangerous if you get it from a feed store because the doses that you would get is much higher and unregulated, so people can get seizures and liver failure. If you take it in a controlled setting that's prescribed, it's very different.
I was looking at a Washington Post story where Sierra Feed and Saddlery in Reno, the owner was describing people coming in for what's essentially a deworming drug and him saying, no, that's for an 1,100-pound horse. That's not for human usage. And they said they'd buy 6 tubes of it after he explained that to them. So sometimes you can give people the vital information and they just, you know, do what they want to do regardless.
Yes, definitely. So that's what I'm worried about. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's right. Dr. Peter Chin Hong with us. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. A chance for you to ask your questions of Dr. Peter Chin Hong about vaccination, about COVID-19, about a variety of different issues that have arisen with the vaccine thus far. At this point, are you seeing any lowering of vaccine resistance among Californians, Dr. Chin Hong?
Yes, I mean, I think we've certainly made gains in overall in the community. I think, the repeated polls have shown that. And specifically, I'm very encouraged by the improvement in willingness to get the vaccine amongst vulnerable populations. I think that is definitely made some headway. I still think there's a core of folks who are still worried about the vaccine. And as we get more and more supplies in the state, That group is going to be much more prominent. So we will need to engage with the group to hopefully get all of us on board against all of the looming clouds that I'm hoping we can escape.
All right. So I want to clarify, we're getting contacted by a number of listeners who on the news that Cal State LA had walk-up vaccination for the J&J vaccine, who've told us they were turned away. Sean in Highland Park called to tell us that. Michael said, we just returned from Cal State LA for walk-up and were turned away. That's Mike in Lomita. Sean says, they told us what was out there was misinformation. Well, Sean, I have to say, I read it right off the state of California release saying that they had all these doses. So what apparently happened was, in the interim period of time, there was so much demand for people eligible for the vaccine, in other words, 50 years of age and older or with vulnerable conditions, they filled up all the appointments. So then there were no doses available for walk-up injection. So that is apparently what's happened. So thank you for clarifying that. And we appreciate it very much for letting us know about what happened. It was the State Office of Emergency Services that had put out that information for the FEMA site at Cal State Los Angeles. But again, you can try and make an appointment at that site, but there is no more walk-up available at that site. We first learned of the walk-up potential yesterday and told you about that, but that's no longer available. All right, let's see. Lorraine in Los Feliz said, my husband had the vaccine back in February. If the vax lasts 6 months, will he need another one in August? Dr. Chin Hong.
So Lorraine's question is great and really reflects the recent news that Pfizer and Moderna show 6 month data as being very, very effective, meaning the participants in the original trial still had protection at 6 months. But that's just really an interim study, and we expect the vaccine efficacy to last, actually some people think it will last years, but the people who were in the original trials will be followed ahead of us because they got the vaccine before us. So we will get information from them long before the community knows they need a booster.
All right, we'll continue with Dr. Peter Chin Hong. We have many more questions to come, including about the precautions for hiking with this beautiful spring weather we've been enjoying and so many Southern Californians looking to head to the hills. We'll hear what Dr. Chin Hong has to say about that. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, with us weekly, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine, UC San Francisco Medical Center. We so appreciate him joining us each week, and we'll be back with him in just 60 seconds. You're listening to Wear Talk on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UC San Francisco Medical Center with us. Mark asks on the AirTalk page, is there enough data now to determine if Britain's strategy of prioritizing first shots and delaying second doses was a good epidemiological strategy? Dr. Chin Hong?
That's a great question from Mike. I think that whatever the strategy was in Britain, it seems to be, you know, relatively a good one for Britain, meaning that the population has seen a great decline in cases. It can, even in the face of B.1.1.7, we also learned subsequently after they implemented the guideline of first shots and then extending the second shot that it was probably okay to delay the second shot by as much as, you know, 6 weeks. So I think the reality is, I believe that most people did end up getting the second shot within a 6 week period, even though it was like all hands on deck, everybody just get one shot the first time. So at the end of the day, most people got the vaccine, you know, in a relatively decent fashion. So yes, I mean, and that's together with the recent CDC data, we know that one shot gives you as much as 80% protection. So, you know, if we think about all of those things, it probably wasn't a bad idea, but if you had enough of it, you would want to give it the right way that it was intended to be given, as in the trials.
Lisa has a few questions about hiking, wondering, is it safe to be around other hikers who are not masked? Does that change that advice if everybody in the group is fully vaccinated? She wonders whether she should always wear a mask when she's out hiking, as you know, she finds that uncomfortable to do so. So what's your advice generally for hiking and masking?
My advice about hiking in general is that it's very safe. It's outdoors. And in terms of masking, if you're just transiently passing a large group of people, you probably want to put your mask on. But if you're with your group and with your posse, it's okay to not wear your mask if your group is relatively, you know, depends on where you're hiking, away from other households. So if there's one household of an unvaccinated person in the group and most people are vaccinated, it's going to be fine. Or if you're not bringing your nose and mouth in contact with somebody else's unknown nose and mouth, that's going to be good. We do know that surfaces are less important. The CDC said that surfaces are you're less likely to get COVID by 1,000-fold or so compared to your nose and mouth. So if you had to prioritize something, it would be your nose and mouth.
One thing I've found with different hikes I've taken over the past year is if it's, you know, quiet, I'll take my mask off on the trail. And then, like you're saying, put it on, you know, when someone approaches, you're going to pass somebody. But here in Southern California, so many of the hiking trails are so busy and people going in both directions that it's really impractical to take the mask off. And, you know, I found you just have to live with it. And, you know, maybe that changes how far you go or whatever. But it's with some of the crowded trails, it's just very difficult to have much time unmasked.
Yeah, I'll go at a different time of day if that's possible, so that you can have a little bit of freedom.
Yeah. 866-893-KPCC. You were just mentioning, Dr. Chin-Ong, about the CDC saying that, you know, surface contact for the coronavirus is just not a prime source at all. Do you think that it's time to end the sort of, you know, deep cleaning, what some would say is this, you know, very zealous cleaning that's been going on in workplaces or at home?
I mean, I don't think it's time to end it, but I don't think we should focus on it. So if we had limited resources, I would probably focus on making sure the ventilation was good or that, you know, people were protecting their noses and mouths rather than, you know, what some people called sanitizer theater of cleaning vigorously. I think it really came down to, some people brought this up around school reopenings, where one of the barriers was the cleaning that needed to take place all the time. And that was bringing emphasis away from the biggest bang for the buck, which was, you know, really protecting those noses and mouths and thinking about ventilation.
Yeah, a lot of schools that are on the hybrid model down here, to my knowledge, are having Wednesday with no students on campus to do that deep cleaning. And then, you know, they come back in the hybrid model for Thursday and Friday. And sounds like you're saying you don't think that's necessary.
Yeah. So the CDC recently put out a risk estimate, I mean, as the CDC can do. And their estimate was that your chances of getting COVID from a surface that was contaminated was 1 in 10,000. So very, very low odds compared to, you know, a very high risk by the way the virus propagates itself is really through droplets and sometimes aerosols, as people know.
Let's talk. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, one last thing about that is, it's not that we're discounting surfaces altogether, but if you just focus on protecting your nose and mouth and washing your hands, it doesn't matter if surfaces are contaminated anyway.
We have Brian in Encino. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. Your question for Dr. Peter Chin-Ong.
Yeah, so I am vaccinated and so is the rest of my family, except for one member who's my mother, who's also a physician, and she's not vaccinated for self-prescribed reasons. So I'm wondering what the future sort of holds for people in our communities that aren't vaccinated, and if my family should take any precautions or how we should behave around her with her not being vaccinated.
Brian, just quick question, clarification. I'm not familiar with that term, self-prescribed reasons. What is that?
She just has decided for her own reasons, her own medical reasons that getting vaccinated.
Okay, she's made a determination was not for her. Got it. Okay. Dr. Chin Hong?
Yes. So I can start with the easy answer, which is that from CDC guidance, Brian and his family can easily, you know, fraternize without protection with his mom, and other people who have vaccinated can come and visit his mom without any protections, as long as it's in that intimate setting. In terms of Brian's larger question, which is how will we as a society deal with unvaccinated folks? Well, it all depends on how many of us become vaccinated so we can protect those who are not vaccinated, but also those who don't have a response because they're immunocompromised or for whatever reason. And that just depends on that concept of herd immunity. So people have thrown around that number of early on of 70%, but now everyone's saying 85% because these variants are more transmissible. The more transmissible something is, the more of us need to be immunized so we can be the henchmen or the force field to protect the people who don't have a response. So, you know, that's the way it will go. So that's why it's so important for all of us to get immunized when we can.
All right. Thank you, Brian. We appreciate it. Let's see. We have, Trisha says, any advice on how to persuade people who are don't want to get vaccinated? Their reason is everyone I hang out with is vaccinated. So why do I need it? What do you say to that, Dr. Chin Hong?
That's hard. I mean, I think that, first of all, stepping back, everybody or many people have different reasons for not getting vaccinated. So when you engage with folks, it'd be great to know why. And because some people might say, well, I heard there's been side effects, or maybe I didn't know anyone who'd been vaccinated. So you can help with those specific remedies for specific instances. For those who are really stuck, I mean, I just think it continues to be engaging dialogue. I mean, it's just like what we see in medicine with people who don't want to stop smoking. It seems that people are stuck in not wanting to stop smoking, but actually over time, people actually change and think and modify their opinions and ideas. So I don't think any cause is a lost cause, and I continue to engage in respectful dialogue and listen to folks.
A CDC official recently said not to take over-the-counter pain medication before you get your vaccine injection. Our reporter Jackie Fortier was doing a piece on this, but couldn't find out how long before injection it was advised to stop taking over-the-counter medication. And also among our medical experts like yourself, Dr. Chin Hong, there's been difference of opinion as to whether that is an important thing to observe or not. So what do you think about this painkillers prior to injection?
I'll say three comments. The first is why people are worried about it. So it's because of historical data showing that in kids, when they took painkillers before, in small uncontrolled studies, they seem to have lower antibody response after the vaccine, the childhood vaccine. The data is actually not very clear that it does anything when you have larger studies, but given that old study, the CDC came up with that guidance. So at the end of the day, if you took Tylenol, ibuprofen, before, we get so many antibodies from the vaccine that I'm not personally worried. In fact, I had a colleague who took it at work because he was afraid of getting side effects, and we're not worried because, but if you had a choice, do it after you get the vaccine, and it doesn't matter how long after, you know, you can take it as soon as you get the vaccine. But if you wait for symptoms and then take it, it's going to be better than taking it before, given those historical studies.
And yeah, in terms of how long a time window before, what would you say, like a day before, hours before, what ideally How long should people go before vaccination, not using over-the-counter pain meds?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So in pharmacology, they usually think about 3.5 half-lives. So if you think about taking ibuprofen every 8 hours, so that would be like a day, like a little bit over a day or so.
Okay. All right. Very good. Let's see. Nicole writes on the page, I had a severe allergic reaction to the first Pfizer vaccine, and both the CDC and my doctors have advised me to not get the second shot. I'm still masking and social distancing, but what does the future look like for people who aren't able to get both shots?
Great question. I think if you can't get the second shot, all hope is not lost, because the vaccine efficacy from one shot is still pretty good. I think we'll understand how long that protection lasts over time, because some people, like in this case, can't get that second shot if they've had a very severe reaction. We know from CDC data that people do have at least, you get 80% protection after one shot. You know, I guess the only question is how long it will last, and we will have that data. So for right now, I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, 80% is amazing if you think the flu vaccine only gives you between 40 and 60% protection.
All right. Anthony writes on our Facebook page, what do you think about the psychological effects of the pandemic and the emotional trauma, how it's affected society? Anthony writes, I literally watch a movie, and when I see people with no mask, I shudder a bit. Do you think that'll go back to normal quickly?
No, I think the huge fallout of this pandemic is going to be mental disease, trauma, PTSD from just seeing all of these things happen. Even if you're sick, it's going to be worse. So if you've had COVID, and even if you didn't have COVID, from just all that we've all been through as a society, that's probably going to be the big fallout. When people have done studies, mental illness always comes up highest. And, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and just like we train everyone in the community to do CPR, I think somebody was suggesting that we, you know, empower many people, many groups, either, you know, police, the police force, firemen, all of these folks to deal with and help counsel people, because these issues of trauma are going to surface more and more in the future.
All right. Thank you so much, as always, Dr. Chin Hong. It's such a pleasure to talk with you and appreciate the expertise. You're called on to comment on such a wide range of things now, much wider than when we started these conversations, and appreciate your willingness to take these on and to also, of course, tell us, you know, what the limits of our knowledge are without having you know, long-range studies in so many of these cases and trying to piece together what seems to be best practices. Thank you, sir, and have a terrific rest of your day.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Appreciate it. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine, UC San Francisco Medical Center. Coming up, in the wake of several very high-profile mass killings in the United States, what decisions do news organizations make about how much time they spend on a particular incident? What goes into that process? We'll talk about that when we continue in 90 seconds on Air Talk.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.